KBOO Portland.
Good morning. That was Old Mole's Joel Clement and Clayton Margridge's rendition of I Wish I Were a Mole in the Ground. You're listening to KBOO Portland, Portland's community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg is engineering. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromised news media. Today on our program, Fran Michel will give us a report on Trump's latest act of treachery, the exclusion of transgender people from the military. Desiree Hellingers interviews Joanne Hardesty, president of the Portland branch of the NAACP, about new and troubling documents regarding the Portland police. I'm sharing a short reading from an article entitled A Future Beyond Capitalism or No Future at All by Jason Hickel and Martin Kirk. Bill Resnick kicks things off with an interview with Arthur Stamoulis. Stamoulis is the director coordinator of the National Citizens Trade Campaign. With NAFTA renegotiations now starting, the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign is holding a town hall Thursday, August 10th, at the Ask Me Great Room on 60th and East Burnside. Right now, trade laws are the only international law that spells out labor rights and environmental protection that have any teeth. Now they can only be used by governments and big business. The town hall is titled Building a Positive Vision for Trade and Trade Policy. Bill?
Hi, Arthur Stamoulis. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Arthur Stamoulis is now the director of the Citizens Trade Campaign. In a prior position, he was coordinator of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign. Now, living in Philadelphia, working in Washington a lot, he organizes and writes and lobbies, and he also coordinates the National Citizen Trade Campaign. The National Campaign is seeking radical changes in trade laws, not against trade or for protection, but in favor of robust trade between countries, but importantly, fair trade. So, Arthur, Trump campaigned on opposing trade deals, renegotiating them, making them fair for Americans, bringing back jobs here. Now, 6 months later, there's a series of trade negotiations going on. They've begun renegotiation of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, most prominent. It's beginning in a week or two. Arthur, tell us about Trump's amazing change of position.
Yeah, well, you know, I think people know Trump got into office in large part exploiting really justified public anger over our trade policies that offshore jobs, that drive down wages, and that privilege corporate elites at the expense of the majority. So he promised voters that he was going to change that, that he would either make our trade agreements better for working people or he would eliminate them altogether. That got him a lot of votes in Midwest swing states like Ohio and Michigan and Pennsylvania, and is a big part of what propelled him into the White House. Since taking office, he has begun the process of renegotiating NAFTA, and just recently his administration published their plan for renegotiating NAFTA. This is a plan that U.S. law requires them to send to Congress.
Actually was leaked, right? In fact, they didn't publish it.
A copy of it was leaked in March, but the actual public plan was published in mid-July, required by U.S. law that they send this to Congress 30 days before they begin negotiations. And that plan fails to take the steps needed to replace NAFTA with a deal that's going to work for working families. Instead, it relies very heavily on language from past business-as-usual trade agreements that have privileged corporate interests over working families like the Trans-Pacific Partnership that Trump had railed against.
A lot of the passages are just copied from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I mean, they're almost virtually identical is what I've read.
No, yeah, large sections of it are verbatim, word-for-word, identical to the negotiating objectives from the TPP. So this is hardly a transformative plan. At best, you could call it vague, and at worst, it's a path to make NAFTA even worse for working families, let alone for the environment.
Arthur, let's go into the details of that. How is that? One of them is people have often said, and correctly, that these are not trade agreements. What they are is corporate protection agreements. And the corporations they're protecting are the big multinationals, and not just protecting, but advancing their interests by putting them into a position where they can just run, do whatever they want around the world in many ways, and have the U.S. government protecting them through these trade laws.
One of the very worst aspects of NAFTA and many of our subsequent trade agreements are these extraordinary protections for transnational corporations. There's a provision in NAFTA called Investor State Dispute Settlement, ISDS, and what it allows is for big corporations that cross borders to challenge any law, any regulation, any permitting decision that they believe violates the agreement before not the U.S. court system or any other country's court system, but a panel of three corporate attorneys who often go back and forth between serving as judges on these tribunals and actually working as lawyers for the corporations. And they can insist that governments pay these corporations unlimited amounts of taxpayer dollars if they find that a law or regulation or a permitting decision is in violation. So corporations have used these to attack environmental laws, food safety laws, you name it. Our domestic laws and every other country's domestic laws in real jeopardy of attack. But beyond that, it also creates an incentive for corporations to move jobs overseas because they don't get these benefits if they're investing and creating jobs domestically. They only get them if they're investing cross-border.
Even if you're in violation of, let's say, the lead and gasoline laws in the United States, all you have to do is move to Ireland, and then you can challenge U.S. law. Is that a...
Yeah, no. It was,
or Ireland or anywhere else, Mexico, go right across the border and bring the stuff in. That's a wonderful provision for corporate manufacturers.
Yeah, I mean, right now, there are only certain trade agreements that have this ISDS provision, but certainly there's been claims of corporations summit hopping and you know, sort of shifting their assets from branch to branch to try to take advantage of the best free trade agreement or bilateral investment treaty to use these provisions. These investor privileges are one thing where if you were trying to create replacement to NAFTA that was good for working people, that's one of the things you would immediately do. You'd get rid of that.
You would at least have transparency, right? And also make sure that your tribunals are, the judges, in fact, are not the minions and the servants of the biggest companies.
Even beyond that, Bill, does anyone think that big corporations don't get a fair shake in the U.S. court system? We don't need a parallel system of justice for the exclusive use of transnational corporations, right? If a corporation has a problem with a law, with a regulation, a permitting decision, it should take them through the U.S. court system, or if it's another country, through that country's court system. It doesn't need private tribunals to adjudicate those. You know, U.S. citizens don't have access to those. The small businesses don't have access to those. If they don't like a law or regulation, there's no reason why transnational corporations should get a special justice system just for themselves.
One of the issues, it seems to me, that is now raised is that the international trade laws now and the kinds that are being negotiated would allow countries and medical suppliers and private hospital systems to sue people like the British are worried. They could sue the National Health Service and the British government, and the Conservatives in government would like to see the National Health Services in England destroyed. Foreign companies could sue England, as it exists now, for not allowing them to build private hospitals, or for regulating their drug prices, or almost anything else, or for allowing some sorts of drugs that are dangerous as trade law violations.
Yeah, no, if a free trade agreement were negotiated between the United States and the UK, and just the other week, the U.S. began talks with the UK about about negotiating such a deal. Stuff like that, it certainly, if they followed the template of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which public pressure defeated, or the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which thus far public pressure has defeated, if they followed that template, you know, that's exactly right. The national health system in England would be in serious jeopardy. And, you know, I'll say even in the NAFTA renegotiation plan, that's one of the sections, intellectual property rights, where the Trump administration lifted a lot of the language directly from the TPP negotiating objectives, language that, you know, doesn't talk about, hey, we need to make access to medicine more affordable for consumers. We need to make sure that people have access to the best quality health care out there. No, it talks about, hey, how can we use this agreement to extend the length of patents for the big pharmaceutical companies and make sure that they're raking in more dough.
And that means that countries like India and many other countries with production capacities and making drugs, life-saving drugs, much, you know, at one-tenth of the price of the American firms, they'd be put out of business by those kinds of trade. You would have to buy American or nothing.
Yeah, the Nobel Peace Prize-winning group, Doctors Without Borders, called the TPP the worst trade agreement ever for access to medicine, and this appears to be the template that the Trump administration is using for NAFTA and presumably for subsequent trade agreements, where, you know, the evergreen patents, meaning that a pharmaceutical company that gets a long patent for a drug, as soon as they find a new use for that same drug, they get an extension on their patent. You can just extend that period of time where they have a legal monopoly and are able to block out generic manufacturers. And as you say, a patented medication can easily be 10 times more the cost of a generic medication. And this is increasing healthcare costs in the United States and in poor developing countries. I mean, it's a literal death sentence. People just simply cannot afford these patented medications.
Yeah, but it's good for investors, Arthur. Think of it that way.
Well, yeah, no. I mean, this is what the president said. I'm going to make these trade agreements better for working people. And thus far, it seems to be that they're headed to making it even better for corporations instead.
Yeah. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Arthur Stamoulis of the Citizens Trade Campaign. He started his career in trade agitation and struggle here in Portland, part of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign, now in Washington lobbying and trying to direct the whole organization. Arthur, let's talk about two important standards, the labor standards and the environmental standards of NAFTA, or in fact of any of the provisions being negotiated. They're there in NAFTA, actually. They're just not enforced, and they're fairly vague, both environment and labor. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so NAFTA includes labor and environmental standards as side agreements. They're not even in the core text of the agreement. The Trump administration's plan on labor and environmental standards, again, is identical to previous administrations' plans for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, and other trade agreements that are in effect. So one of the standards is that, hey, countries are required to have minimum wage laws and laws pertaining to maximum hours of work per day, but it doesn't spell out what those standards are. So a country can have a minimum wage of $1 a day and a maximum number of hours worked at 24 hours a day and still be in compliance. So they're a joke. And then other labor provisions have to do with the right to organize a union and freedom from forced labor and things like that. But again, the standards are so vague that thus far they've been completely impossible to enforce. And these are labor standards that are wholeheartedly endorsed by the Chamber of Commerce and other corporate lobbies and universally panned by labor organizations in this country and many others. It's like, look, these are window dressing.
And the environmental standards are similar?
The environmental standards are quite similar. It's interesting, the George W. Bush administration, at least on paper, required enforcement of 7 multilateral environmental agreements, you know, essentially environmental treaties. The Trump plan that was released the other week talks about enforcing 1 of those 7. So a rollback already in that regard, let alone, you know, not saying anything, obviously, on climate change, you know, one of the biggest issues facing humanity today, completely silent on that. So, you know, in my opinion, these labor and environmental standards, I mean, not only are they completely inadequate to protect jobs at home and human rights abroad, but again, they're window dressing. They're thrown in there so that they can say they're doing something for the public when really they're not.
Now, there was one issue that where there was some action, actually, right? And the Amazon rainforest issue. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so 10 years ago, the Peru Free Trade Agreement under the George W. Bush administration was the first trade agreement to have in the core text these labor and environmental standards. Supposedly these were, you know, a great leap forward, but they were supposed to take care of illegal logging in the Amazon, which is a huge problem for endangered species. It's also a major problem with forced labor in that sector.
And not to mention the climate of the planet.
No kidding, yeah. No. But, you know, 10 years later, the illegal logging continues virtually unabated. There's been no enforcement case that's been seen to fruition that's tried to impose any penalty whatsoever. Illegal logging continues to happen hugely. Environmental activists continue to be literally killed trying to fight the practice in the Amazon. And by and large, it's been a joke. It's been a sick joke. And yeah, this is one of the things that was used to sell that trade agreement. There's no talk of improving the standards, learning from that, you know, those mistakes and improving the standards to actually make sure the environment is protected, that labor rights are protected. You know, these are the standards that are being offered to us still.
Arthur, before we end, let's talk about the NAFTA town hall that's happening in Portland on August 10th at 7:30 p.m. I've got the details in front of me, and in fact, that is the detail. Learn about the unfolding NAFTA politics and what can be done. Again, it's Thursday, August 10th. At 7:30 p.m. at the Ask Me Consul 75 Hall, which is at 60th and East Burnside. It's right on the corner there, 6025 East Burnside. Arthur, what can be done? The town hall, of course, is one small component, but town halls all over the country are important in getting to the media and talking about trade and jobs and the solutions. Give us a sense of the politics of it.
So after seeing so many pro-NAFTA corporate lobbyists invited to testify at NAFTA hearings that were held in Washington, D.C., we decided to work on our own series of field hearings about NAFTA that are going to allow working people, family farmers, immigrants, small business owners, environmentalists, others to explain the impacts that NAFTA has had on their communities and what sort of changes they want to see in a real NAFTA replacement deal. So this is something we're doing this summer throughout the country, including the one you mentioned in Portland. One of the key things I'll say is, so this is August recess, congressional recess. This is the longest time in the entire year when members of Congress, you know, U.S. representatives, senators, are back home in district interacting with constituents. Most of the year, they're in D.C., they're taking meeting after meeting with corporate lobbyists. They're at fundraiser after fundraiser with corporate lobbyists. August through Labor Day is the time where they're back home in district, and they have to interact with voters, with their constituents face-to-face. So this is a critical moment for us to be putting the question to our elected officials, hey, is this NAFTA renegotiation for people, or is it for corporations? You know, who's going to benefit from this? What are you doing to make the process transparent and to hold the Trump administration accountable? And I think the more we can raise that type of accountability, the better the chances we'll have at cutting off the worst possible sort of TPP 2.0 outcome of this renegotiation, and potentially over time actually get a better deal, which is what we all need.
Right. Arthur, one final thing. I want you to have the last word. Comment on my hypothesis that we have to really fight in these trade negotiations left for different trade laws. But one of the great things that it does is it talks about the planet and the entire trade regime and the way people live and work and share goods and share the planet. And what we can do is raise questions of what are the minimum standards that are necessary, and then talk about how to build a international cooperation on raising the minimums for so many people living now on less than a dollar a day still in the world, and for making sure that people have shelter and medical care and work, and there is so much work to be done in environmental restoration. All of that, my hypothesis is, Arthur, that we want to link and also appeal to all the Sanders supporters. It seems to me that Sanders also ran on trade, and that resonated with the American people. It seems to me that it's quite possible to raise all of those questions in these town halls and around the country and talk about, you know, a very different way of managing the world economy and the world environment, especially the U.S., but of course all the other countries are damaging unto human extinction.
No, I think you're right. I mean, one of the big innovations of trade agreements is that, you know, they not only set rules governing the global economy, but they have enforcement mechanisms in them with real teeth that get governments to obey them. So unlike a environmental treaty or an armistice treaty that, you know, largely rely on the goodwill of the governments involved, our trade agreements have mechanisms in there that are, you know, have very real penalties involved for violations that can force governments to change their actions.
They're unfortunately not used.
The problem is that they're used to force governments to extend the length of medicine patents and copyrights, and to prevent the use of environmental regulations and food safety regulations and things of that nature. They're not used right now to lift labor standards, to lift environmental standards, to set a floor for food safety and consumer right to know and things of that nature. We just need to flip the script. We need to create rules that are designed to benefit workers and consumers and the environment rather than to just benefit corporate profits. But the mechanisms are there. We just need the political will to make those very simple changes. And, you know, I'll say I was heartened in the last election that Bernie Sanders did so well, running in large part on the need to change our trade policies in that way. I think the Trump campaign was very cynical and had a very U.S. against the world sort of message when it came to trade instead of corporations against the world message. But I think he tapped into much of the same public anger around this issue. And I think if people just continue to hold elected officials accountable and not let them get away with these half measures and business as usual measures wrapped up in nationalist rhetoric, I think real change is possible. We just need to keep fighting.
Arthur Stamoulis of the Citizens Trade Campaign, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Well, thank you, Bill.
How the years passed again and the giving was good, with a lunch bucket filled every season. But with three babies born, the work was cut down to a half a day shift with no reason. Then the shaft was soon shut and my work was cut, and the fire in the air, it felt frozen. Till a man come to speak, and he said in 1 week that number 11 was closing. They complain in the east, they are paying too high. They say that your ore ain't worth digging. that it's much cheaper down in the South American towns.
Close the door, please.
Where the miners work almost for nothing.
This is the Omo Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was, of course, Bob Dylan, North Country Blues. Now, Fran Michelle, on Trump's trans tweets, the role of gender in the right wing imaginary, and the divided responses from left and liberal commentators.
You've no doubt all heard about Trump's trans tweets last week. The three Twitter messages in which he declared that transgender people would not be allowed in the military because of what he called tremendous medical costs and disruption. These arguments have been debunked, of course. Trans people are neither expensive nor disruptive. And more broadly, the assumption that healthcare needs to be rationed on the basis of cost fits well with the apparent ruling class assumption that most people are generally not worth keeping alive. Some have interpreted the tweets as a distraction from policy issues like healthcare insurance reform and from political scandals like conflict of interest charges or Russiagate investigations, for instance. Masha Gessen points out that to describe as a distraction the president's declaration that a group of Americans are second-class citizens and his promise of a policy reversal that would directly affect thousands of people is, quote, not only a grievous insult to transgender people, but a basic failure to understand the emotional logic of Trumpism. This is a logic that Trump shares with most modern-day strongmen, and it was this logic that made his attack on LGBT rights so predictable, even while he was literally draping a rainbow flag over his body last year. Trump got elected on the promise of a return to an imaginary past, a time we don't remember because it never actually was, but one when America was a kind of great that Trump has promised to restore. Trump shares this brand of nostalgia with Vladimir Putin, with Hungarian President Viktor Orban, and with any number of European populists who promise a return to a mythical traditional past. With few exceptions, countries that have grown less democratic in recent years have drawn a battle line on the issue of LGBT rights. Moscow has banned pride parades. In Erdogan's Turkey, water cannons were used to disperse an Istanbul pride parade. Narendra Modi's India has recriminalized homosexuality. In other words, queer and trans rights are anything but a distraction. They are a frontier, sometimes the frontier, in the global turn toward autocracy. In Trump's imaginary past, every person had his place and a securely circumscribed future. Everyone and everything was exactly as it seemed. The very existence of queer people, and especially transgender people, is an affront to this vision. End quote. As Jack Halberstam notes, this is a time, at present, when the visibility and acceptance of transgender people has never been higher, when high school students openly discuss issues of gender variance, and businesses boycott states without transgender bathroom policies. End quote. But as Gessen points out, the growing visibility of queer and trans people has coincided with the precipitous loss of economic security, the disappearance of lifelong careers, the rising sense of a world transformed by the movement of people across borders. Scapegoating trans people for the economic and other disasters of the present is not serendipitous. Political Research Associates reports that 2 days before Trump's trans tweets, the Family Research Council, FRC, a right-wing political advocacy group based in Washington, D.C., issued an action alert to its members, enlisting their support in denying health care to military personnel who are transgender. FRC argued that providing medically necessary treatment to trans people is a distraction from the military's purpose. 2 years ago, in June 2015, the FRC laid out a 5-point plan for responding to the transgender movement, which specifically argues against allowing trans people the right to serve in the military, in addition to withholding gender-affirming health care, access to gender transition procedures, legal recognition, and protection from discrimination. Working in conjunction with Focus on the Family, the Alliance Defending Freedom, and other leading Christian right organizations, FRC advances its anti-LGBTQ, anti-abortion agenda through reports such as that plan, as well as through lobbying efforts, media work, and high-profile conferences, namely the annual Values Voters Summit. which last year featured unprecedented appearances from the Republican presidential and vice presidential candidates. Moreover, Trump's transition team included figures from the FRC, which is using its close proximity to the president and vice president to further advance its anti-trans agenda. In a press release following Trump's Twitter announcement, FRC's president, Tony Perkins, applauded the president for keeping his promise to return to military priorities, end quote. Both Perkins and Trump's language hark back to one of the oldest tricks in the right-wing playbook. Set up a dichotomy between the deserving and the undeserving, and drive a wedge between them. The right's new portrait of liberalism run amok is the quote-unquote delusional trans person, whose only real delusion is that employees deserve non-discrimination protections and health care coverage. Trump's description of trans people as being a burden, and FRC's suggestion that trans inclusion is a distraction, is simply the newest chapter in the right's fear-inducing mythology of parasitic, undeserving takers in American society. This inhumane framing serves as justification for gatekeeping economic opportunities and civil rights for marginalized people and conceals how destructive so-called austerity can be, end quote. Yet this scapegoating has also resonated with tensions in left liberal politics, with more mainstream liberals promoting the patriotism and brave service of trans people in the military, and more radical left voices noting that we should be banning cis people from the military, as there's nothing progressive about an institution that is dedicated to killing people, as I've heard supporters of Trump's policy characterize the military. An institution that's damaging not only to the enemies Trump supporters want the military to crush, but damaging also to those who enlist. Dean Spade points out that 30% of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans have contemplated suicide. 43% say they are not seeking mental health care because they fear it will negatively impact their careers. And 80% say they do not think that vets are getting as much care as they need. This left versus liberal tension is precisely the angle that Democracy Now! Took in reporting on the trans tweets. Amy Goodman opened the show about it by saying, quote, "While President Trump's ban on transgender people from military service has been widely criticized even by fellow Republicans, it has reignited a debate within the LGBT community. Some have questioned whether the discourse on transgender rights should be broadened to include a critique of militarism," end quote. But as Matilda Bernstein Sycamore objected, anti-war queer voices should be the ones at the center of anti-war left media coverage. The show devoted most of the segment to interviews with trans soldiers who extolled the glory of the U.S. military without any serious questions. Dean Spade appeared briefly at the end of the segment, even though, as Sycamore notes, Spade's values are more closely aligned with those of Democracy Now! And its listeners. As Spade has noted elsewhere, quote, "The liberation we're working toward requires that we fight for vets and everyone else who gets exploited and abandoned by the U.S. military imperialism, but not that we participate in rhetoric that celebrates the U.S. military as an employer or tries trans well-being to military service," end quote. Those of us opposed to the current militarist and autocratic political trends need to be less divided in our recognitions that no one's life is a distraction. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel.
And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO-FM Portland. These days, capitalism isn't winning any popularity contest. A recent poll of the nation's youth showed that a narrow majority believe capitalism has had its day. Today, I'm reading from an article entitled "A Future Beyond Capitalism or No Future at All" by Jason Hickel and Martin Kirk. In February, college sophomore Trevor Hill stood up during a televised town hall meeting in New York and posed a simple question to Nancy Pelosi, the leader of the Democrats in the House of Representatives. He cited a study by Harvard University showing that 51% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 29 no longer support the system of capitalism, and asked whether the Democrats could embrace this fast-changing reality and stake out a new, clearer contrast to right-wing economics. Pelosi was visibly taken aback. "I thank you for your question," she said, "but I'm sorry to say we're capitalists, and that's just the way it is." It's not only young voters who feel this way. A YouGov poll in 2015 found that 64% of Britons believe that capitalism is unfair, that it makes inequality worse. Even in the U.S., it's as high as 55%. In Germany, a solid 77% are skeptical of capitalism. Meanwhile, a full three-quarters of people in major capitalist economies believe that big businesses are basically corrupt. Why do people feel this way? Probably not, because they deny the abundant material benefits of modern life that many are able to enjoy, or because they want to travel back in time and live in the USSR. It's because they realize, either consciously or at some gut level, that there's something fundamentally flawed about a system that has a prime directive to turn nature and humans into capital, and to do it more and more each year, regardless of the costs to human well-being and to the environment we depend on. Because, let's be clear, that's what capitalism is at its roots. This is the sum total of the plan. We can see this embodied in the imperative to grow GDP everywhere, year on year, at a compound rate, even though we know the GDP growth on its own does nothing to reduce poverty or to make people happier or healthier. Global GDP has grown 630% since 1980, and at the same time, by some measures, inequality, poverty, and hunger have all risen. What becomes clear here is that ours is a system that is programmed to subordinate life to the imperative of profit. Once we realize this, we can start connecting the dots between our different struggles. There are people in the U.S. fighting against the Keystone Pipeline, people in Britain fighting against the privatization of the national health care system. There are people in India fighting against corporate land grabs, and people in Brazil fighting against the destruction of the Amazon rainforests. There are people in China fighting against poverty wages. These are all noble and important movements in their own right, but by focusing on all these symptoms, we risk missing the underlying cause, and the cause is capitalism. It's time to name the thing. What's so exciting about our present moment is that people are starting to do exactly that, and they are hungry for something different. For some, this means socialism. That YouGov poll showed that Americans under the age of 30 tend to have a more favorable view of socialism than they do of capitalism, which is surprising given the sheer scale of propaganda out there designed to convince people that socialism is evil. But millennials aren't bogged down by these dusty old binaries. For them, the matter is simple. They can see that capitalism isn't working for the majority of humanity, and they're ready to invent something better. People want health care and education to be social goods, not market commodities, so we can choose to put public goods back in public hands. People want the fruits of production and the yields of our generous planet to benefit everyone, rather than be siphoned off by the super rich, so we can change tax laws and introduce potentially transformative measures like a universal basic income. People want to live in balance with the environment on which we all depend for our survival. None of this is actually radical. Our leaders will tell us that these ideas are not feasible. But what is not feasible is the assumption that we can carry on with the status quo. If we keep pounding on the wedge of inequality and chewing through our living planet, the whole thing is going to implode. The choice is stark, and it seems people are waking up to it in large numbers. Either people evolve into a future beyond capitalism, or we won't have a future at all. That article was entitled A Future Beyond Capitalism or No Future at All by Jason Hickel and Martin Kirk. Jason Hickel is an anthropologist at the London School of Economics. Martin Kirk is a co-founder and director of the Strategy for the Rules, a global collective of writers, thinkers, and activists dedicated to challenging the root cause of global poverty and inequality. Now, Desiree Helligers is with us now, concluding our program today. Desiree interviews Joanne Hardesty, president of the Portland branch of the NAACP. They'll be discussing the documents that were released this week by the City of Portland regarding the Portland Police Bureau's settlement agreement with the Justice Department. The documents, which have critical implications for both the 48-hour rule and the civilian oversight of the implementation of the settlement agreement, may be voted on as early as this coming Thursday. Desiree?
So, my guest today is Joanne Hardesty, president of the Portland branch of the NAACP. Joanne, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us by phone to help us to understand the implications of this, really a raft of documents that were released just on Friday and that are coming up for a vote this coming Thursday at 3 p.m. So can you tell us a little bit about the implications of these documents and maybe also a little bit about the process and timing of their release so quickly before the City Council potentially moves to a vote on Thursday?
Well, this seems to be a consistent record with Portland City Council, which is to release hundreds of pages of documents that the public is supposed to digest almost overnight and be able to have intelligent conversation on. So I think there are three really big fundamental changes that are being proposed to the settlement agreement between the Department of Justice and the City of Portland as it relates to Portland Police. Now, the big one is that our last mayor, Charlie Hales, patted himself on the back and when he got rid of the 48-hour rule, when he paid a small fortune to get rid of the 48-hour rule. Your audience may not remember, but the 48-hour rule gave police officers who killed someone in the line of duty 48 hours to calm down enough to be able to articulate what happened in that incident. Now, the DA, the Department of Justice, and the City of Portland attorneys have been meeting behind closed doors since March and came out with a proposal, a policy recommendation that says that police officers should not have to give any written report of a death in custody until after the grand jury process has been concluded. Now, our DA, Rod Underhill, says this is necessary because if a police officer was going to be charged, if they had been compelled to testify ahead of time, they would not be able to charge them. And I would answer that with, there's only been one time in the history of Portland Police Bureau that an officer has been charged in the shooting of an unarmed community member. Only once in the whole history. And so it is a fake argument to put into law that basically police don't have to say anything after they kill a community member until after the grand jury process. And we know the grand jury process almost 100% of the time clears police officers, even when they kill someone running away and they shoot them in the back, they're always cleared by the grand jury. So what this means for the public is that no accountability police kill people in our community. So that's the one big piece. The other big piece is the settlement agreement actually required a community oversight body to make sure that the changes that were proposed by the settlement agreement were truly being implemented by Portland Police Bureau. And again, behind closed doors, the city attorneys and the Department of Justice and the Portland Police Association have come up with this convoluted plan to replace the Community Oversight Advisory Board with what really amounts to a PR group appointed solely by the mayor to provide, supposedly to create better community police relations. That is not what we need when we're spending tens of millions of dollars to reform Portland police practices and patterns of behavior.
So as I understand it, the COAB, as it's currently been configured, allowed each city council person the appointment of a representative and then 10 other positions that would basically be screened and appointed or nominated by community members versus this new iteration of a 5 to 9 member committee, all of which would be appointed by the mayor.
Absolutely. So in the original concept of the Community Oversight Advisory Board, the Human Rights Commission had 5 appointees. So between the Human Rights Commission and the Disability Rights Commission, they identified 5 people who would serve on the Community Oversight Advisory Board. 5 people were identified by a community panel of community members. 5 non-voting members were appointed by Portland Police Bureau. And 5, as you said, were appointed by the City Council. I'm really troubled that the entire City Council is on the hook for the millions of dollars we're spending on reform. Yet this new proposal puts the mayor alone in the driver's seat. Now, and you can either like or dislike the current mayor, but in my view, that is too much power in the hands of one individual who really hasn't shown that he is capable of reforming Portland Police Bureau.
Yeah, it's interesting to note that even the DOJ's press release heralding the 2014 agreement noted the significance of the COAB as a kind of what it describes as a crucial mechanism for civil engagement in the reform process. And it's precisely that mechanism that's really being undermined and weakened by this new iteration.
Well, quite frankly, being gutted, because nothing in this new reiteration gives them authority to review any changes that are proposed based on the community oversight community liaison, who you might remember is the very overpaid Chicago consultant that does drive-by review of whether or not Portland Police Bureau is really fundamentally changing their pattern and practices. And so we are still paying this consultant from Chicago $250,000 a year. He's now doesn't even have a community oversight board to report to, and that's been since January. So here we are almost in August, and what the mayor is telling the city council is they have to do this because otherwise they're out of compliance with the settlement agreement. And my response to that is hogwash, because when the judge told them they were out of compliance last October, the city decided to sue the judge to say he didn't have authority to demand they come back and report on how they were going to get back into compliance. And it was interesting because the community group was smart enough to actually appoint alternates. The city council wasn't smart enough to appoint alternates. So when their people resigned or took new positions, they did not replace those people. So that's why since January, there has been absolutely no community oversight of any settlement agreement policies and recommendations.
And so you're saying also that there's been closed-door meetings that lasted from March to July, and all of a sudden we're getting these documents released on the Friday and the push to vote on those by Thursday in the wake of that kind of months of basically delay in closed-door meetings.
Exactly right. And I am so profoundly, you know, maybe this is what happens under Sessions Department of Justice, but I'm pretty appalled to think that our mayor and the city attorneys would go along with this. Why would the mayor take the advice of Rod Underhill? They are both duly elected leaders. And if the mayor really wanted to hold police accountable, he would reject Rod Underhill's advice that police officers can't give a statement until after they've been cleared by the grand jury. I mean, that is unacceptable in a community that's demanding police officers treat everyone the same. And we certainly don't have that today, and it will definitely not be possible under the proposed changes that will be in front of the city council on Thursday.
So it sounds like there's a kind of a pattern here, both in terms of the timing of the release of the documents, the lack of community input, and then the basic kind of attack on the whole framework of the COAB.
Yeah, and in fact, some of the documents imply that the community was involved in criminal behavior. So basically, we can't trust the community to know what's in the best interest of reforming Portland Police. I totally reject that premise. It is absolutely an insult to activists who, A, call the Department of Justice to Portland because the city council refused to act when police were continually using excessive force against community members. And so as part of the community group, the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, who invited the Department of Justice to town, I feel like they have just basically disregarded and cut out community oversight and community accountability. I mean, if this passes, what it means is the police force will have free rein to do whatever they want in any community with no accountability whatsoever. And that cannot stand. One other thing I wanted to mention in this new reiteration, they don't even mention the racial profiling reports and actually collecting data on who is being stopped, who is being searched. That was a key component of the settlement agreement that was supposed to be overseen by the Community Police Relations Committee, which was a subcommittee of the Human Rights Commission. But that group has not been active since the settlement agreement was adopted. And so rather than talk about how we're going to get the new data and get annual reports on who's being stopped, the report just eliminates that requirement. The new settlement agreement just eliminates that requirement.
Okay, yeah, so we're really seeing a very significant weakening of the overall oversight. Can you talk a little bit more about the accusations of criminal behavior by the community included in these documents?
I was amazed to read in the documents that are in front of the city council that one of the reasons for this change is that somehow the community was out of control when the Community Oversight Advisory Boards met in public. This new reiteration would have most of their meetings behind closed doors. So they would not even be, they would not even have to follow open meetings laws. And that's why they're trying to put it together this way. So basically, it would be just an advisory group for the mayor.
Okay,
why does the mayor need his own PR group to make the police look better?
Okay,
what will make the police look better will be to demilitarize them, which is what the mayor promised when he was running for mayor. What would make them better would be to make sure that when they show up at protests, they don't show up in riot gear and show up looking like they're headed to a war zone. That would be a big improvement. But nothing that's being proposed by the DOJ in the city of Portland would give any community member confidence that we're going to be able to have oversight on what's going on within the police bureau.
So I understand that this new PCCEP, the kind of new alternative to the COAB, would have quarterly public meetings and then twice monthly closed door meetings. So out of a total of, 28 meetings out of the year, only four of those would be accessible to the public.
Right. And if you look at what their charge is basically just to figure out how to make the place look good. We don't need a volunteer community group to try to make the place look good. The police have PR people to do that already. And so I think this is just a smack in the face of people who want real change, who want a leader that's going to hold police accountable for how they treat all community members. And this is not reflected in these documents at all. In fact, this is going backwards. Who would have known that Mayor Wheeler would actually be more egregious around policing than the former mayor, Charlie Hales? I thought we couldn't get any worse than Charlie Hales when it came to holding police accountable, but I'm starting to think that Mayor Wheeler is going to be far worse because clearly he has sided with the communities the problem and not the police.
Okay. And can you just tell me, are the documents that you referenced, all these documents that were released on Friday, are they available online anywhere right now?
Yes, they are. So if you go to the city clerk's website, all those documents, if you go to the city council agenda website, if you just put that into your search engine, all those documents are available online now. And I mean, there are hundreds of pages, and that's part of how they ram through changes that the public doesn't understand, overwhelm people with a lot of paperwork so that they don't take the time to really read it in detail. But they should know that the community activists have been reading these documents for the last 5 years. So we're very familiar with what was in the original settlement agreement and what the proposed changes are that are being proposed by the city, well, quite frankly, by the mayor and by the Department of Justice and the Portland Police Association. Now, they were paid off with a 9% pay raise to get rid of the 48-hour rule. Does that mean that they're going to have their pay reduced since the 48-hour rule no longer, since now, they don't have to give a statement at all? The Department of Justice in the original settlement agreement required police to file an after-action report the day of the incident. And so the Department of Justice is backing way, way, way back from their mandate that police officers write a written report the day of the incident.
Okay, and so presumably, though, any votes that the city council takes on these documents will still have to be approved by the DOJ?
Well, the DOJ has already signed off on them.
Okay.
The DOJ thinks this is a great thing. This is a different DOJ because the DOJ under the last presidential administration would never have signed off on a ludicrous proposal like this. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very concerned that, you know, I thought this DOJ wasn't the DOJ of my childhood, but this one certainly does not reflect the wants or desires of the community.
So we're really getting the impact of the Trump DOJ, and
yes,
the city
are.
Seems to be maximizing that opportunity to roll back any kind of progress.
Yes. I think this is Jeff Sessions' fingerprints are all over this so-called agreement, because there's no normal people would never accept. But that's like me saying, I'm not going to talk to a police officer until I've gone in front of a grand jury and made my case to the grand jury. Mm-hmm. Now, if community members don't have that option, why would we give that to police?
Right. Yeah. So I just want to remind people that the hearing is at 3 p.m. this coming Thursday. So all of these documents have just been released on Friday, and the hearing is coming up on Thursday. So it's critically important to have a strong community showing. And I also just want to mention that an earlier interview that I did with Dan Handelman from Portland Cop Watch will be available alongside the audio of this interview with Joanne Hardesty of the Portland branch of the NAACP. And those will be put up in the next, hopefully the next 24 hours, so that people can also hear the analysis of Portland Cop Watch. So, yes. Joanne, I really want to thank you so much for speaking with me today.
It is absolutely my pleasure. Thank you so much for the call. And I think the best thing that can happen is that we overflow the city council chambers, and that we make sure that the phone lines are ringing off the hook in opposition to these proposals, because this is not in the best interest of people in the city of Portland. And it certainly isn't about justice. It's about hiding from justice. And so I hope that the city council rejects this proposal, and that we put enough pressure on them to make them do so. So thank you.
Okay, thanks so much.
Have a good day.
You too.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As Moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives, to move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new world order in which not only humanity, but other species as well can thrive and lead fulfilling lives within ecologically sustainable environments. From the Mole's perspective, such struggles that chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. This is KBOO Portland.
If I'm a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole.